Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We're going to keep reflecting on the Psalms. And I think many of you were here for the last session, and we read this quote from Nahum Sarna, who is a Jewish scholar who has done a terrific amount of work on the Psalms, and actually with a working group, and wrote this little book out of it, which, while it only treats about, 10 or 12 texts from the Psalms, has a wealth of information about how to read them and their background. It's this latter point that we made that I think is so important to remember. Remember the comparison that the Torah has five books, the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, which are seen in Jewish tradition as God's revelation to his people. The Psalms are organized into five books later on and are seen as God's people speaking back to God. And I like this last statement. The biblical Psalms are essentially a record of the human quest for God. And in every way, we looked at a couple of texts 2 weeks ago, Psalm 1 and 2, which I suggested are a prologue to the Psalter. One of them is a wisdom psalm, the one about blessed is the man. So it has the text about the difference between the righteous way of life and the wicked way of life. So that's laid out, reflecting on the Torah itself. Remember, the man that is not blessed is the one who walks in the way of the wicked and stands in the way of the sinner and sits in the seat of the scoffer, the person who mocks God. But the righteous man is different than that. It says his delight is in the law of the Lord, the Torah of the Lord, and in that law he meditates both day and night. Which, and that, then there's a simile. He's like a tree planted by streams of water, well-rooted by streams of water, and whose leaf does not wither, and in everything he does, he prospers. And that language of meditation, of Torah, day and night, of prosperity, is exactly the same language that comes from Joshua 1, which is the heading of the second part of the Jewish Bible. Law, prophets. Joshua is the first part of the prophets, has a text exactly like Psalm 1, and Psalm 1 is, of course, the heading of the third part of the Jewish Bible, the writings. So the Jewish scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, is organized around this sense of meditating on the Torah, and Psalm 1 tells you that's what's happening. These texts are a way of meditating on the Torah, God's revelation, and then speaking back to God. Psalm 2 we looked at is one of those royal psalms or a messianic psalms. It talks about a king who is an anointed one. We know the term Messiah. And of course, when we get to the New Testament, the apostles take that term, the Greek equivalent, Christos, Christ, and apply it to Jesus. So that text, Psalm 2, would be associated with Jesus by the apostles. Of the categories, we're going to look at a couple of others today. We'll look at a couple of psalms that are both liturgical psalms, but each of them has a really significant historical element, so we're going to knock off two categories at one time. So, and then what we'll do next week is we'll look at supplication and lament, or complaint. So we will have hit everything but praise, thanksgiving, because that's the one you're most familiar with, probably. So let's dig into a text and see what we see. And just like we did a couple of weeks ago, let's read this together. This is how this would have been done, although this one, as you read it, you'll see has some question and answers, and more likely than not, that would have been done antiphonally. There would have been a group stating the question, and then the people reciting an answer. And this was likely done in a procession up to the Temple Mount. This is one of those psalms. And as you reflect on the subject matter, you'll see why they might have used this psalm liturgically when they were going for a feast. Sarna notes that this one would have been used for at least three feasts during the year on the approach to Jerusalem and you going up to the Temple Mount. So let's read it together. The earth is the Lord's and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it. For he has founded it on the seas and established it on the rivers. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? Those who have clean hands and pure hearts, who do not lift up their souls to what is false and do not swear deceitfully. They will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from the God of their salvation. Such is the company of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. Selah. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Selah. I should have prompted you. Those are parenthetical in the English, but they're in the text. And no one actually knows what they mean. The supposition is that it is a cue, either a musical cue for an interlude, or that it is simply instruction for everyone to pause. And the kind of modern tradition is to pause, to take just a pause at the text at that point.
Are you referring to this term,
Selah? For those who think it's a musical interlude, the supposition is that they actually accompanied a lot of these with instruments. And at that point, there would have been just a musical interlude of 8 to 16 measures to do the same thing, though, to make you think about what you've just heard and recited. So that's a liturgical instruction of some kind. What do you see in the text?
It starts out.
Sounds like creation.
It's a pronouncement at the beginning, and about what?
Creation.
Yeah.
Well, Genesis is the creation story, yeah. So that'd be the same thing.
The earth is the Lord's, and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it, founded upon the seas and established on the rivers. I'll note the established on the rivers is the kind of kinder translation that's... remember, these are written in Hebrew, they get translated into Greek. And in the Greek text, it says rivers. In the Hebrew text, the term is really more like a torrent or a flood. So river is a little bit innocuous. Because when I hear river, I think of a meandering body of water, and it's bucolic and calm, when in fact the notion here is you have raging seas. I will tell you that there are a number of scholars who see in this, just like they do in Genesis 1, a kind of anti-pagan polemic here. That you remember the like in the Enuma Elish, one of the ancient, like the Babylonian creation myth, there's the notion of these sea monsters and this raging battle, and that creation happens because these divine figures are warring with each other, and the sea monster has to be tamed or slain. And that what happens in the Genesis text is to say, well, sure, the waters may rage, but they're just raging waters, and Elohim, Yahweh, dominate. He made them all. So he controls them all. So it's a different way of stating this ancient creation story. And this may be a reference to that in a poetic form, when you have seas and torrents, the idea of the raging waters that would keep life from emerging, and they have to be pushed back. And remember, the Genesis text, God just... and you have dry land. This is a reference to that. That's exactly right. So we begin with a reference back to the Genesis narrative, the Torah, right? And remember, this is what's happening in Psalm 1. His delight is in the Torah, Adonai, and on that Torah he delights day and night. Well, here it is. It's meditation on the Torah. What else happens then?
Is he making reference to Moses?
How so?
Climbing the mountain.
Oh, going up the mountain? That's an interesting question. The Temple Mount is surely in view, but I think you're onto something here, that the idea that, I mean, there are mountains, right? There's Mount Sinai, where Revelation was given. There's the Mount in Jerusalem, where God comes and dwells, and his glory is revealed. You see Jesus when he's teaching the woman at the well. This mountain, that mountain. High places are important in this culture. Where you would build your temples.
Is there a reference to Abraham through Jacob?
Well, there is. Yeah. The God of Jacob. You have, I mean, their God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? There are lots of references. Abraham was the first to go up a hill to worship.
To sacrifice Isaac.
Oh, well, right. There's another mountain, by the way. Yeah, we don't want to forget that one. So, yes, the reference to God of Jacob. The question is, why it's God of Jacob here? We might want to hold on to that one. Not God of Abraham. Not God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But God of Jacob. So we're posed a question about the hill, and that is, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in the holy place? And then the way that we know this is reference to the temple is that, his holy place. It's just a single term that refers to the temple.
Reference to the Jewish nation?
Yeah, it's a reference to their monument of worship. I mean, that's what the temple was. It was the monument in the midst of all of the other peoples that this was the house of God. So they're asking, who gets to go up there? Who shall go up, and then who shall stand? And the answer is what?
Those who have clean hands and pure hearts.
So clean hands, pure hearts, a way of talking about a kind of ethical righteousness.
And don't lift their souls to what is false.
So they don't worship idols. So they don't lift up their souls to what is empty or vain. And then do not swear deceitfully or take an oath deceitfully. So the question is, who gets to go up to the holy place and who gets to stand there or stay there? And the answer is, people like this. They will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from the God of their salvation.
Who is the God of Jacob? Why is it just the God of Jacob?
Let's hang on to that. Let's wrestle with that. So look at the whole verse 6. Such is the company of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. And then we have our little instruction, which may mean, think about that.
But now, wait a minute. Jacob was deceived. Didn't he deceive his father?
No,
wait a minute.
He
deceived Isaac on the birthright because Esau was the eldest.
Now the text gets more interesting. Because when you hear the question, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord and who shall stand in his holy place, and you get the answer that those who have clean hands and a pure heart, who do not lift up their soul to what is false and who do not swear deceitfully, what's your response to that? I mean, if you're the worshiper and you left your little village and you've come for the feast and you're heading up toward the Temple Mount and you become a part of this liturgical procession and you hear the recitation of this, what are you thinking? Not the what's your outward kind of veneer of, well, of course the righteous get to go up to the temple. What are you really thinking?
Think that none of us.
Well, right. Who qualifies for this, right? And then there's this reference to this deceitful fellow named Jacob. But how is he characterized? So we know the story of his deceit. Do we know another story about Jacob?
Wrestling.
Yeah.
And what did he do in that lead? Do you remember?
He wouldn't let go until...
Until God what?
Revealed his face.
Yeah, he wanted to see the face of God. He wanted God's blessing. I think the reason it's God of Jacob here is because they're hearkening you back to a Torah story, which is to say in Genesis 32, the people who are like this are the kind of people like Jacob who grab hold of God and won't let go. They seek God that way. You're in the midst of struggling with, well, who matches the qualifications of verse 4? Who is that? I mean, who among us actually are like that? There may be a couple of things going on. One is this is a reminder that priests who are doing service in the temple go through ritual purification in order to qualify to serve in the temple. And I think surely this is being brought to mind, but it is clearly raising the question about who is worthy to go up to the holy place where God dwells.
Was it Jacob who was renamed Israel?
Yes.
That's right. 12 tribes. He becomes Israel. There's a lot loaded into the little name, God of Jacob. It evokes all of these memories. These people would have known the Torah. They would know these stories and would be thinking exactly the things that you're thinking with reference to God of Jacob.
But wasn't Jacob wounded by the angel when he saw the face
of
God?
Yeah, he limped forever.
He limped from then on?
Yeah.
So doesn't that tell you that even though I've wrestled with God, I've seen God's face, you are touched, but I'm still superior to you?
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
Would some people look at that and say, clean heart, pure heart? Don't lift up my... That's me.
Some would. Yeah, I think some would exactly see that and say, well, sure, I got that covered. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure how honest that would be. I don't think it would be at all, but I think that's true. I'll tell you how Martin Luther's, when he grapples with this text, you know, Luther really struggled with sin. What to do with his sin, even small sins. And he sees in this, and it is actually valid, the language of vindication. So you have, they will receive blessing. There's our president's name again, Barak. Remember, we discussed that in Psalm 1. The typical Semitic term for blessing is Barak, or Akah. But in Psalm 1, and remember, it wasn't that. It's Asherah. That's not who receives something that comes from the outside, but you have a kind of happiness inside. Here we have our Barak. You'll see blessing from the Lord. And then vindication, which is you're made righteous. Luther would look at this and say, ah, this is actually the gospel, that nobody actually has clean hands and a pure heart. You have to receive blessing from the Lord and made righteous. And he will, Luther's principle for interpreting all the text was, Charles knows this, I know, but it was to look for Christ in everything. And he'll see Christ right there in verse 5. And he will talk about the notion of imputed righteousness, that this is what happened. This is, you are given the righteousness of God when you approach in a certain manner. And that is the manner of admitting that you don't actually qualify for this. Now, for the person walking up that hill, of course, they know of a system by which people can be purified. That's actually the point of the exercise, the liturgy that they're going through. It's to be cleansed. Charles?
It occurred to me that Paul, in Romans 5, has something like this in mind when he has the transcendence of God, which is mind, body, show that he had chosen Jacob.
Jacob.
And Esau for their role before they were born. So it is not a matter of their behavior. He's saying it's a matter of what God mysteriously chooses for his own purposes. And apparently he considered Esau a dunderhead compared to Jacob, who would carry his people forward.
And this is where you get Jacob he loved and Esau he hated. Yeah, yeah. So we have the creation, the reminder of the creation story, and then immediately an ethical question is posed. And I think it quickly gets to this, where you start thinking, wait a minute, I know I don't actually meet that standard as much as I should. It shows you shortcomings immediately, and then in verse 6 lets you know, almost as if it builds the anxiety, and then in verse 6 to say, such is the company of those who seek him. So it gives you a cue. Oh, the kind of people who seek Yahweh are people like Jacob. It doesn't let you off the hook, but I think it actually lets you exhale because you realize Jacob was a really imperfect fellow, yet who is equated as somebody who seeks God. And I think the obvious reference is that notion of him hanging on to God and clinging to God. and seek God in that way. It's a really interesting effect of one saying high ethical standard and then letting us all existentially realize that that doesn't actually work, because if that's the standard, then nobody gets to go up the hill and stand in the place of the Lord. It poses you with that dilemma in this liturgical poem. Now, what comes next may seem like a real shift, because suddenly this question is there, and then suddenly there's this command, "Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in." This is where some scholars believe we have two texts put together, that you have an earlier poem wedded to a kind of victory poem that might be associated, say, with the ark being brought up to the temple or something like that. It has the language of the warrior god in it. You have a couple of terms, the reference to God El Gabor, which is just the idea of a sheer warrior who's armed for battle. A victorious warrior. And then one that we know it from some of our liturgical language. This is Lord Sabaoth. It's actually, Sabaoth is the Hebrew term. It's a loan word in English. And it's not Lord of the Sabbath, it's Lord of Hosts. And that is, the hosts are a great army. So this latter part of the poem is actually this warrior text. So after the question, who gets to go up and who gets to stand, and we're reminded that those who seek God are the kind of people who seek God like Jacob, then comes the call. But it's not a call to the people. Who's called?
The gates and the doors.
The gates and the doors. What is that? I mean, in this case, it's the temple itself that's being called upon. The temple is to be readied for the King of Glory to come in. And this, the notion of glory here, it's a word that means weight. The substantialness, if we could coin that term, of the king. The king is going to come in, and the temple itself should ready itself for the presence of this king to come in. And then the question is asked, well, who is the king? Who is the King of Glory? And the King of Glory is the Lord, the strong and mighty, the one mighty in battle. And then the call again to the temple to be ready, lift up your heads, O gates, be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. The question comes again, who is that? And the repetition, the Lord Sabaoth this time, he is the King of Glory. So up here, we had a recollection of creation. And then down here, you have this remembrance that the King is Yahweh, who is the one who's the defender of Israel, the one who fights for Israel.
And the reference to battle, talk a little, is that the resistance that the Jewish nation was encountering?
I think it's certainly in that context, but remember that, I mean, they took the land by conquest. That's how they did it. And then the reference to the ark, the kind of obvious reference would be, remember, the Philistines took the ark. And then David goes and gets the ark back from the Philistines. And then the ark is carried back into the city in a kind of haphazard way. Remember, one fellow loses his life over that, and then brought in a festal procession after that. Charles?
It occurred to me that actually two creation stories right there on the screen. The creation of the world, and now we're talking about the creation of Israel.
Yeah.
And the creation of Israel, the creation of the world, is actually for, I'm adding this, all of my own.
Yeah.
It's actually for the creation of Israel. The world didn't just occur by accident.
Yeah.
It occurred in order that there be the creation of Israel. And then, that's the story and the finish on my view, and then that is for the creation of the church.
This is a really good point. I haven't thought of it this way in this text, but one of my teachers, Hebrew teachers, John Salehammer would love this. He would be sitting in the corner grinning at this point, Charles, because he would say the Torah, actually the opening chapters of Genesis are exactly about that. That the whole use of in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, that term is actually not, it certainly makes you think of the globe. But what it's really about is the land where the people can dwell and be made a people. And then, of course, from that, you would have the people of God in total. Yeah. He sees that in the first chapter of Genesis, by the way. And I think you see that in the ancient Hebrew commentator Rashi, also the medieval commentator, this notion. I've never thought of it in this text. That's a really good insight to this.
Yeah, but that sets you totally up for conflict because you have...
Oh, of course it does.
And it's total turmoil because the Jews don't accept Jesus because he's not the Messiah. Then you have the first Jews that were the first Christians. And then you have Abraham as the father of three faiths, which is Christian, Jewish tradition, and Islam. And so you just got total turmoil. And
potentially.
All of the early history of Israel... It's very malicious. I mean, they take whatever they want,
right.
Kill one, whoever they want. They don't even spare children or goats or sheep. They slay everything.
Yeah, and I'm saying that the language, the names for God here are references to that tradition. They are. That's embedded in this poem. It's the little hymn at the end of this is actually a militant hymn. But it is a reference to the ark being brought back to Jerusalem.
It is interesting, though, that that's kept in the context of God of Jacob, because it's set right after recalling the story of God himself, an angel of the Lord, wrestling not on behalf of Jacob, but wrestling with Jacob. So there's a sense that God actually battles his own people in order to prepare them for
Well, and that actually, there's another, yes, and we have the whole notion that once the people actually don't fulfill God's intentions, they're put in exile, and the temple is destroyed. It's taken away from them, and they are allowed to come back, and don't forget to note the name of the city where this is, Jerusalem. We had a friend from Tunisia who visited here. And she was so curious about why we named the place Salem. But what does that mean?
Peace.
It's the city of peace. Yeah. So I would say to this that whole notion that carries on to this day in the minds of some, that this should be about war and division, is actually the opposite. Once the temple is built, Solomon prays a prayer of dedication, and in it he prays for the day when the people of all the nations will come and worship together. It's not the notion that everybody should be kept apart, it's that everybody should be brought together. And of course in the Christian tradition this is exactly what Jesus picks up on, right? It's the people's coming together. It's not just Jews but Gentiles, everybody being brought into one place. So it's clearly a part of the tradition, and it's part of this poem. But I think this is a really good point, that God will war against his own people if they don't get this right, and that the intention isn't to divide or conquer, but the intention is actually to bring everybody back together. The intention of this text, though, is to ask, how will everyone be able to go up to the place where the God of glory is? Charles?
I was just going to say, and God will... war against those people who threaten the existence of the people of destiny, which is predestined. This is where predestination is.
Well, John Calvin didn't get that close, but
no, he didn't. No, this conception of predestination is individual predestination. I'm talking about the predestination.
He means of
the world.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
The destiny of the God accomplishing God's purposes. Yeah. So I'd like to point out something else about this psalm. that is really important in, you know, when we've talked about the Bible before, I've made a lot of the way that the canon is organized, but I think those who edited these texts were actually quite thoughtful about where things go. And I think this happens in the Psalter. I think in some ways with Psalms and Proverbs, they get put together. It's a big collection of texts and they get put together. But it's not without intention. And does anything strike you about where this psalm is? We just know it is Psalm 24. That just means that it's in a numerical succession.
Right after 23.
Yeah, and what happens in Psalm 23, Lyons?
Goodness and mercy.
Yeah, this may give you a little insight into Psalm 23 when you hear it again, that it is organized the way it is, that it's located where it is. Because you close that with, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the
house
of the Lord forever."
Seems like this would have been a better place if it came after 24.
Well, or that Psalm 24 is actually conditioned by your reading of Psalm 23. Because now, when you think about going up to the temple, I think it is very easy to take something like Psalm 24 in a kind of militant way, to be quite the victorious people, that we've won the battle, and we're going up to the mount, and we will worship there. And it's that sense of, yeah, I fit that description. Psalm 23 puts a very different twist on that. When you think of house of the Lord in the sense that I dwell there because the God who is a God of goodness and mercy brings me to that place. And when I'm in the midst of my enemies, God's the one who sets up a table to have a feast. I mean, who does that, right? Who has dinner in the midst of the battle? And now house of the Lord is given a certain context, and then you turn right around, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness therein. And going up to the house of God, I think, is given a bit of a different twist by understanding Psalm 24 in the context of Psalm 23. I can't promise that those who compiled it had that in mind, but I just don't think these things are accidental.
I think we should look wherever we can for inspiration. I mean, they're not just doing their own individual thinking about this. They are actually inspired at certain levels in doing what they do.
And I believe the editors were inspired. I actually believe this, that when people talk about theories of inspiration and they make a lot about every word and jot and tittle, I think the compilation of these texts must have been inspired. And I think you have lots of indication this being one of it. It's a very subtle thing, but it makes you think differently about that temple up there. It's not a place where we go to have a victory celebration because we slaughtered all the people around us. It's the house of God where the God who is a shepherd dwells. Now, God of glory, with all of the, you know, Lord of hosts language and all of that, is tempered by the Lord who is a shepherd, who makes me to lie down by green pastures. And by the way, that's not a passive term, the lying down. That's actually a shepherd term. It's not to say, oh, please come in and have a lay down. It's actually the animal being forced down to rest. It's that kind of language. So, just a thought that the context of this psalm may give us a clue about how to read it.
And if you read outside the context, outside the context of the Christian tradition, all you get are human thoughts and inventions. In other words, you get the Bart Ehrman approach to all of this. You just assume from the beginning that this is a human thing. And you know, you get this from Nietzsche and all this, all human power activity, human efforts to explain human relationships and to insert, as it were, the author into the situation with greater power. So it gives them power over the text.
Yeah, I don't know how to read these texts outside there. I mean, you have to read them in, they're in their context, so you have to read them there. I also think that what's an interesting thing about this, although in the early psalms, like around these psalms, you have a designation, Mizmor, Ladavi Mizmor, so it's a Psalm of David. By the way, Psalm 24 has a superscription in the Greek that says, a psalm of David, it adds something. The translators of the Greek Hebrew Bible added something, which is for the first day of the week, or for the Sabbath. So that's a, and in some traditions, when the Torah is brought out of the tabernacle in the synagogue, they would chant Psalm 24. As if the going up is happening when the Torah is brought to the people. Does that make sense? Yeah. Because the temple is where God's presence comes to dwell among the people, and the notion is that what was given to Moses is God's revelation to the people, so it's being brought out. So that's Psalm 24 in the context of Psalm 23. Let's take a moment to look at another psalm, and we won't read all of it. It's quite long, but this is another liturgical psalm, and I just want you to note what happens with this. So this is a liturgical psalm that is actually quite historical. So you have this opening, give thanks to the Lord for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. The for his steadfast love endures forever is two Hebrew terms. Just two. And the second of which is kesed, kesedu in this form. And that's translated steadfast love. That is when you go to Jerusalem or when you're on your flight on El Al and you see the fellows in black with the locks, they're called what? The chasedim. Kesed, that's from this term. So you have this reference to the loyal ones, those who are steadfast in their love or loyalty. That comes from the Hebrew term that's attributed to God. That is that God has steadfast love or loyalty to his people, so that when he makes a promise, he won't break the promise. And you have all kinds of markers like rainbows, right? God won't flood the earth again. That sort of thing. Well, this is a term that is loaded with meaning about the nature of God and God's loyalty to the people. This refrain goes throughout this entire psalm. And what probably was happening is there was a reciter or a choir that would sing the first part, and then the people or another choir would do the little refrain over and over and over and over. And there's not a handy English way to do what happens in the Hebrew, but for his steadfast love endures forever is a good translation of this. So you have the general thanksgiving, give thanks to the Lord for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of gods, for his steadfast love endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his steadfast love endures forever. Note what happens next. Who alone does great wonders, who by understanding made the heavens, who spread out the earth on the waters, who made the great lights, the sun to rule over the day, the moon and stars to rule over the night.
You're right back in Genesis.
We're right back in Genesis. You see a pattern here? I love to reflect on the opening in the Torah, but it's a really important theological point. They're going back to the creation because the notion is this is God's world. God made it. God is Lord of it. Really simple point, carried out in all these little lines that are snatched from the Genesis text with the refrain, for his steadfast love endures forever. It's a way of meditation. Remember, his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on that law he meditates day and night. This is meditation in practice. I mean, this is the notion of meditation. To take these thoughts about God from the Torah, which are seen as God's revelation to the people, and to mumble them over and over. And that, I told you, that meditate is the idea of mumbling it to oneself. Here, the people are together reciting. We do this every week, right? We do the same thing in the liturgy. So, creation. Once again, note what happens next. Dr. Bird, you're going to be distressed by this.
Probably so.
So we have the same refrain all the way through, but now watch what happens. After creation, we now have, the Lord of Lords, who struck Egypt through their firstborn and brought Israel out from among them, with a strong hand and an outstretched arm, who divided the Red Sea in two and made Israel pass through the midst of it, but overthrew Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea, who led his people through the wilderness, who struck down the great kings, who killed famous kings. We may as well get some names in. Sion, king of the Amorites, for Og, king of Bashan, and gave their land as a heritage to his servant Israel. So we have creation in the first stanza, if you will, and what do we have now?
Rescue.
Rescue? In what sense?
Leading them out of captivity.
Moses left them, let them out of
Egypt. So deliverance from Egypt. So we have their deliverance, and then what? Yeah, their triumph and conquest of the land that was promised to them. We can go back to Charles's rubric, creation of the world, creation of Israel. All with the refrain, for his steadfast love endures forever. And again, imagine two choirs, or a choir and the people, back and forth, back and forth. And what you end up doing is reflecting on the steadfast love of God. Final stanza. It is he who remembered us in our low estate, for his steadfast love endures forever, and rescued us from our foes, for his steadfast love endures forever, who gives food to all flesh, for his steadfast love endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the God of heaven, for his steadfast love endures forever.
And that goes right back to Genesis. In a way, the God of heaven is the God of creation.
Mm-hmm. Gives food to all flesh. We move from creation of the world to the creation of the people of Israel to it is he who remembered us in our low estate, rescued us from our foes, once again deliverance is in view, and then kind of the ordinary, mundane, he gives food to all flesh, and give thanks to the God of heaven, right back to where it started. All of it framed liturgically to get the congregation to reflect on the chesed of God.
When you have the Torah as the first five books, and then you have the laws and the prophets and the Psalms, all of it refers back to those first five books. In some
I continue to say that the prophets and the writings are, in one sense, a commentary on the first five books. And then I think when the New Testament comes along, they're doing very much the same thing. A third of the New Testament is a quotation of or allusion to these texts. The apostles very clearly are, because these were their scriptures. They were trying to come to terms with how these texts were to be read in light of the appearance of Jesus.
Do we know that were the Psalms originally written as a book, if you will, or when they organized the Bible, if you will? Did they piece together separate songs?
The latter. Yeah. There's no evidence that they set out to do a hymn book. There was not a hymn book committee in Israel doing this. This isn't the 548 BCE hymnal. They were compiled around that time, we believe, that
could be in the multiple authors.
And multiple authors, sources, and were organized somewhat differently in different collections. I mean, you have at least one additional psalm that shows up in some collections, and then you have certain texts like Psalm 9 and 10 are divided. That was one psalm in early canons, collections. So they weren't completely uniform, but I'd say quite uniform fairly early on. And by the time you get to the time of Jesus and the apostles, these texts are pretty much set, with maybe one variation.
Or and this may be beyond the scope of what you're doing here, but are Proverbs meant to be read in tandem with the Psalms, or as a continuation but maybe a different form of wisdom.
But certainly a different use, but it is wisdom literature, and both in the writings. Like Job, though. I mean, they're all kind of tucked together. Ecclesiastes, these texts are all put together in the writings. These were used publicly for the congregation. Proverbs, I don't know of a tradition of the Proverbs being used in the same way. I'm not saying they weren't taught, I'm just saying liturgically like this.
So the Psalms was set to music?
Yes, apparently so. And some believe there's actually, I'm trying to think where she's from, maybe a scholar at UCLA? I can't remember where she is. Who has written a book that actually a lot of the sort of diacritical markings in the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text, the old Hebrew text, were actually musical notations rather than just accents and those sorts of things. That is not universally agreed to, but you have these arguments that there were musical notations, but there's all kinds of references to them singing and reciting things.
So there's not a music that you can play for.
Yeah, there's not remaining, not that's ancient. Now, there's all kinds of later settings. There's a long tradition of settings of these, but I don't know of anybody who has tried to reconstruct any of the ancient. Of course, you never know when tunes, for example, have lasted. You don't always know exactly when they started, right? You don't know how old they are. You may know the earliest reference to them, but that may not be the first time they wrote. That's also why when you hear people talking about these manuscripts, I think of Bart, and it's, you know, it's on that date. Well, that's when we found that manuscript. That doesn't mean that text didn't exist before. It just means that's when you found that text. It's the same argument about the canon of the New Testament, that, you know, our earliest reference to the list would be sometime in the later 2nd century. Well, it doesn't mean that there wasn't a list that existed before. It just means we don't have it. So, draw what conclusion you will from that, but you can't argue that that's the earliest time that people actually respected these texts. It just means that's when that papyrus was found.
That means you have an agenda.
More directly put, yes. You have to be careful about the dating on these things, because the fact is we simply don't know. And this doesn't just apply to these texts. I mean, it applies to all kinds of ancient texts. So I think you have to be cautious about being too dogmatic about dating on these things. Yeah. Which you can tell just by looking at really respected scholars who just have different ideas about how to date all of this. Yeah. So some of it we just don't have. I wish we did. I actually did a in graduate school work on the hymn fragments in the Greek New Testament. And I expected when I got into it to find all of this, like a treasure trove of information about the settings and music and everything, and almost nothing. Because I thought I might write my dissertation on it, and ended up realizing I'd just be speculating about a bunch of ancient texts, which didn't seem very interesting to me at the time. Because there aren't even ancient Greek music. There's just so little, we just have fragments left. And that's later than what we're talking about here. Yeah. The nice thing, though, is that through history we have all kinds of wonderful settings that still exist, right? Yeah. So, next week we'll take a look at supplication and lament. We'll have a couple more psalms to look at.